And our first speaker is Leanne McDougall. She's going to talk about issues related to anemia, iron, and erythropoietin therapy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a great pleasure to present on this very important topic, I think, to all of us that are practicing nephrologists. I think we're very lucky that we live in an era where we have an effective treatment for the anemia of renal failure. Of course, our predecessors from 10 or 20 years ago were much less better off. They had to rely on regular blood transfusions. Nowadays, of course, by using a combination of an erythropoietic substance plus iron supplementation, we have the capacity to treat renal anemia effectively, and we can bring the hemoglobin up from really quite astonishingly low levels, as it was in days gone by, to really quite respectable levels. In fact, we can bring it up to whatever target hemoglobin we choose. And we know that this has undoubted benefits for the patient in terms of their exercise capacity, their ability to exercise, their quality of life, and their cardiac function, and so on. And what I'd like to cover over the next half hour or so are just these issues. Why should we treat renal anemia? What is the rationale for this? When to treat renal anemia, with some strategies for anemia management? How to treat renal anemia? And I'll have to talk about EPO and darbepoietin alpha and the role of iron. And I'm going to finish off with just what's new in this year in terms of the concept of once-weekly erythropoietic therapy, a brief word about ACE inhibitors and response to EPO. And one cannot these days give a talk on anemia management without at least mentioning PRCA, rare though it is, but concerning also that it is. So that's basically the outline of my lecture. For those of you that are trying to follow it in your program books, I think you'll find the slides slightly differ on occasions, for which I apologize, because the beauty of PowerPoint presentations is you can modify them even to the extent of the very last minute. And I've modified every single time I mentioned anemia to spell it the American way, just so as it would satisfy most of you. Of course, I come from a country where we spell anemia a funny way. First of all, I'd like to talk about why we treat renal anemia. And I think the bottom line is we treat renal anemia for one very simple reason, because chronic anemia is bad for you. And there's a lot of circumstantial evidence now to support this objectively, as well as just asking the patients how they feel. And if we're really being honest, there are two reasons why we would treat renal anemia. One is to improve the symptomatology in the renal failure patient, improve their exercise capacity and quality of life, recognizing that many of the patients are so used to their chronic anemia that they may be a poor witness of their symptoms. Even if we don't improve symptoms, there's overwhelming evidence now that we have secondary benefits to the patient in terms of particularly cardiac function, and morbidity and mortality data are also emerging. And if we just look at some of these, this is a typical outcome that we want to avoid. This is a young patient, 26-year-old hemodialysis patient who sadly died. This is an autopsy specimen showing this large transmural myocardial infarction. This was as a consequence of massive left ventricular hypertrophy. At post-mortem, he had normal coronary arteries, so it wasn't atheromatous coronary artery disease. This was simply left ventricular hypertrophy outgrowing its own blood supply as a consequence of long-standing hypertension and anemia. And we know from data from ADHERE 11, data that I think you're very familiar with, that looking at varying degrees of renal dysfunction, this is at the point where the patient starts dialysis, 75% of these patients have evidence of left ventricular hypertrophy, and this starts at quite an early stage, even with mild renal impairment, with creatinine clearances between 50 and 75 mils a minute. There are other data that we can look at. There's data from, again, from the Canadians, Patrick Parfrey and Rob Foley, looking at the prevalence of cardiac disease when patients start dialysis. Only 16% of patients in this population analysis had a normal heart echocardiographically. And varying numbers had systolic dysfunction, left ventricular dilatation, and nearly half of the patients had concentric left ventricular hypertrophy. Now, does this actually matter that the patients have this? Well, the nice thing about this study is they followed these patients up and they looked at survival. This is basically a Kaplan-Meier survival curve. And you can see that if you've got a normal heart, you do reasonably well in dialysis. This is at the point where the patient started dialysis treatment. If you have systolic dysfunction, your chances of being alive at 5 years are only about 20%. And if your chances of being alive at 5 years, if you've got left ventricular hypertrophy in the brown, is only about 50%. These are very depressing statistics, to have to tell our patients that they've got a 1 in 2 chance of being dead at 5 years from the day they start dialysis if they have LDH. Well, what can we do about it? There are things we can do about it, but before looking at that, just some other data. This is data from a Spanish study, looking at quality of life. The lower the score, the better the quality of life, and you can see that hemoglobins above 12 have the best quality of life in terms of sickness impact profile scores, both globally and physical dimension scores. And this just, again, shows data from Rob Foley from about 5 or 6 years ago, looking at your relative risk of various cardiac abnormalities compared to reference of, obviously, 1. And you can see that if you've got left ventricular hypertrophy at 1, interestingly, in this study, left ventricular hypertrophy did not come out as strikingly obvious as in other studies, but other abnormalities such as systolic dysfunction, left ventricular dilatation, and death were increased by varying amounts depending on even just a small decrement in the hemoglobin concentration of only 1 gram per deciliter. And then we've got Alan Collins' data, which you're well aware of, looking at the relationship between hematocrit and length of hospital stay as the main endpoint here in relation to comorbid conditions. And basically, it doesn't matter how many comorbid conditions you've got, the stratification at all the hematocrit levels. And obviously, if you're anemic with a lot of comorbid conditions, your chances of being in hospital are going to be very high. Now, we know from a lot of studies, and this just summarizes the literature, I'm not going to show you all of this, but this summarizes all the benefits of correcting anemia in dialysis patients over the last 10 years. And you can find quite a body of literature to support all of these benefits for the individual patient. I'm not going to go through this list. It's available to you in your books if you want to take a note of it. The question is, when should we start treatment? And about 10 or 12 years ago, when we first became aware that we had an erythropoietic agent, we thought nothing of let the patient get anemic, start them on dialysis, and then correct their anemia at that stage to whatever target level we wanted to achieve. And then there was a move in the mid-1990s, largely driven by Joe Eschbach from Seattle, to try and look at higher hemoglobin levels. In other words, to take the patients on dialysis and bring them up to a higher target hemoglobin level. Now, we're aware of several studies that looked at this strategy. I summarized probably the 5 best known ones in the world, including the US normal hematocrit study that Tony Bessera published in the New England Journal 4 or 5 years ago. Now, what have these studies taught us? Well, I'm just summarizing what they've taught us. They've taught us that we cannot reverse or fully correct left ventricular hypertrophy, left ventricular dilatation from the Canadian study, or exercise capacity to normalize it once these abnormalities have set in. The US normal hematocrit study, although it didn't prove anything, had concerns that it might increase the risk of death by normalizing hematocrit. There were 4 other studies that were more reassuring, the big Scandinavian Canadian studies. They didn't have safety concern, but there were only modest benefits seen. So we were left really thinking this maybe isn't the right strategy to go for, and perhaps in individual patients it may be appropriate to normalize, but maybe not in large populations. So the next strategy was to look at, instead of waiting till the patient's on dialysis and correcting the anemia to whatever level you wish, just to think about starting at an earlier stage, in the CKD or pre-dialysis phase of the renal illness. And we can take that one step further, of course, to look at prevention of renal anemia completely. And there are, in fact, as you may be aware, large worldwide multi-center studies looking at this very strategy. And I'm summarizing some of them here. I'm not going to go through any of them. None of them have fully reported yet. The best one probably is the CREATE study, which is now about to finish recruitment as of probably next month. It's now only about 20 or maybe even less patients short of its target of 600. And that's a prevention of renal anemia study. So we have at least data that's in the pipeline. How to treat? Well, there are various ways of looking at this. One has to think about nutrition, dialysis adequacy, hematinic deficiency. Iron is pivotal to anemia correction. Erythropoietin therapy, and now, of course, we have darbepoietin alpha therapy, so this is really erythropoietic therapy, and perhaps some adjuvant therapies to erythropoietic agents in addition to iron. I'm just going to flash through these very quickly. We know that malnutrition exacerbates the anemia of chronic renal failure. Our patients, when anemic, obviously lose their appetite, so they have a low dietary intake of things like iron and other essential minerals. One is duty-bound to give them dietary advice, particularly with regard to protein intake, vitamins and mineral supplements. So we mustn't forget about nutrition. It's very easy these days just to think about apolipoic iron. Dialysis society can say, well, we know the patients must be well dialyzed, and in the context of this hemodialysis educational course, very important to remember the patients have to be adequately dialyzed. We think this is due to the fact that there are inhibitors in uremic serum that suppress erythropoiesis. In the 1970s, these were the substances that were putative inhibitors of erythropoiesis: spermine, spermidine, putrescine, parathyroid hormone, probably less so now, and inflammatory cytokines are emerging as well. We know from the TASSAN data, which we've already heard about this morning in another context, that increasing a dialysis prescription in terms of long hours dialysis will improve anemia. Very few of the patients from TASSAN data actually require erythropoietic substances. And of course, you'll hear a lot at this meeting at the ASN about daily dialysis. If you can do it, again, you've probably less chance of getting anemic. So we mustn't forget about good dialysis. It does maximize erythropoiesis. Hematinic deficiency. A lot of our patients have inadequate dietary intake of folate. And these substances are low molecular weight, and they can be lost during dialysis, both folate and B12. Having said that, folate and B12 deficiency are much less common than iron deficiency in terms of causing anemia. Iron is clearly the most common hematinic deficiency, and of course you get excessive iron losses via the dialyzer and the GI tract. A lot of our patients are on aspirin and they get heparin during dialysis. We know that there are two types of iron deficiency. There's absolute iron deficiency with low ferritin levels, and there's functional iron deficiency where the ferritin levels are quite reasonable, but there may be evidence of low TSAT or hypochromic red cells. And I think you're aware of these are the three main parameters, certainly in Europe, for looking at iron status. They look at different things. The ferritin is good for iron stores, the TSAT is good for circulating iron in the plasma, and the hypochromic red cell is good at looking at iron incorporation into the red cells. Now, you have NTF-DOCI guidelines. We do respect them, but we have our own. We have the European best practice guidelines, and they were, of course, modelled on the NTF-DOCI guidelines and adapted, really, for the European practice. This is guideline 6 from the European best practice guidelines. It's very similar to what you'll find in DOCI or in NTF-DOCI 2. Serum ferritin is above 100. If you're measuring hypochromic red cells, you want them below 10%, and if you're measuring TSATs, you want them above 20%. That's the minimum. And what the guideline says is, in order to get these as a population, you should be aiming for ferritins between 200 and 500 in your dialysis population, aiming for hypochromic red cells less than 2.5%, and TSATs not just aiming for above 20%, but really aiming for between 30 and 40% if you want to maximize anemia correction. Giving iron, well, you can give it orally. It's very simple and cheap. Unfortunately, in our population of patients, it's poorly absorbed, and there are a large preponderance of GI side effects. You only have to look at one of the posters at this meeting from Chariton and colleagues to show that the comparing oral and intravenous iron, far more side effects with oral iron for the patient than there was in the IV iron limb. And that's a poster at this very meeting in a day or two's time. Intramuscular iron, I don't think should be used. It's available. It's very painful. Injections can cause brownish discoloration of the skin, bleeding into the muscle, and again, there's variable absorption. So we've come to recognize that many patients require intravenous iron. It's readily available, it's effective, and it reduces the dosage requirements of EPO or dabrapoietin alpha. These are the four iron preparations, IV iron preparations available in the world. In the US, you've got iron dextran still, you've got iron sucrose, and you've got iron gluconate. Problems with iron dextran and the anaphylaxis, and certainly these days in the UK, very rarely used. We use iron sucrose mainly in our unit. Iron gluconate is used elsewhere in Europe, particularly Germany and Italy. Trouble is you can only give low doses and there's a risk of free iron. And iron dextrin is the iron of choice in France and Australia. So it does depend on which country of the world you're in, which iron you might use. Regardless of which iron you use, you can either give it as a low dose every dialysis, 20 or 60 milligrams. You can give it as a medium dose, which is the dosing regimen that we use, about 100 milligrams every week, or if the ferritins are rising a bit, we give it just every month at this dose. Or you can give a high dose, 500 or 1,000 milligrams. In the hemodialysis population, which is what this course is about, really these are the better strategies to use rather than this one. And there's, again, I refer to the abstract by Chariton and colleagues, as emerging data that we should be thinking about giving it as a push rather than an infusion for quite a number of benefits. And then just a brief word about what do you do about the patient who has a high ferritin level, functional deficiency and is not responding well to erythropoietic substance? Well, there's certainly data from control data from Taiwan to suggest that you try IV ascorbic acid, 300 milligrams every hemodialysis session for around 6 or 8 weeks. I've done this, I found it works in some patients but not others, and it's certainly not the be-all and end-all of things. Right, and then just to finish off a brief word about EPO, or when I talk about EPO, I'm talking about erythropoietic substances. So we're talking about recombinant human erythropoietin and darbepoietin alpha. Recombinant human erythropoietin is the first one that we had. The development was begun with a major breakthrough in 1977 when human erythropoietin was isolated from a huge quantity of urine obtained from patients with aplastic anemia. This allowed the gene for human EPO to be isolated and cloned in 1983. Once you've got a gene for a human protein, very easy to get a suitable vector to, which was Chinese hamster ovary cells, to synthesize the stuff on a large scale basis. And we then had the first clinical reports in dialysis patients from Chris Winnells in November 1986 and Joe Eschbach in the New England Journal in January 1987. And then, of course, throughout much of the world, recombinant human erythropoietin became licensed for clinical use in either 1989 or 1990. In the world, we have three main commercially available erythropoietic substances. We've got epoietin alpha, marketed as Epogen in the US, Procrit in North America for the CKD population, Epex in Europe. Epoietin beta is marketed by Roche as Neurocormin, not available in the US. And darbepoietin alpha is available worldwide as RNS, as a second-generation erythropoietic substance from Amgen. What are the differences between the different erythropoietic substances? Well, the major difference is in the intravenous half-life, slightly longer half-life for epoietin beta than alpha, longer half-life for subcutaneous use with beta rather than alpha, but the major difference is the darbepoietin alpha is this much longer half-life, threefold any of the erythropoietic substances, and with subcutaneous administration, a doubling of the subcutaneous half-life. And this is the data that showed this pharmacokinetically, that basically I presented the ASN a few years back and was published in JASN 3 years ago, showing this difference in half-life with 25.3 hours for darbepoietin alpha and 8.5 hours in this particular study for epoietin alpha. And of course, we're well aware that the difference is largely due to the fact that darbepoietin alpha has two extra N-linked glycosylation chains caused by altering the protein backbone of the molecule by 5 amino acid changes. This makes the molecule heavier, obviously, with the extra glycosylation. And with the extra carbohydrate structure, this allows the molecule to be more stable in a biological environment. Well, what about EPO therapy? And I'm talking now just about EPO, not darbepoietin alpha. We know that EPO therapy is highly effective from the large multi-center studies that suggest that 90 to 95% of patients respond. That's a very good response rate. And tomorrow in the workshop session, I'll be focusing on the ones that don't respond as clinical problems. But the majority respond. The NKF DOKI guidelines and the European best practice guidelines both concur that the recommendation should be subcutaneous. And yet in the US, as you're aware, with the reimbursement schemes that you have, only around a quarter of patients are actually receiving subcutaneous epoietin. In Europe, it's much higher than this. And there's Kaufman's paper in the New England Journal to show that really lower doses are obtained subcutaneously rather than intravenously. Recommended starting dose is around 2,000 to 4,000 units 2 or 3 times a week. And I'll come back to once weekly administration just in a minute. If you're giving it subcutaneously, you can inject into any of these three sites. You'd be looking for a hemoglobin response of roughly 1 or 2 grams per deciliter a month. You have to monitor iron status carefully, and of course you recognize that around a fifth of the patients might get an exacerbation of hypertension, so you have to monitor the blood pressure. What about darbepoietin alpha? Well, marketed as a once weekly therapy, and again, very high response rate, once weekly administration. The interesting data from the darbepoietin alpha is that subcutaneous seems to be equivalent to intravenous. There's no real difference between the routes of administration in the data that's so far available comparing subcutaneous intravenous darbepoietin alpha. So different from recombinant human erythropoietin. Starting dose somewhere in the region of 20 to 30 micrograms once weekly. If you're converting patients from EPO to darbepoietin alpha, it's a 200 to 1 conversion, but maybe at higher doses is a higher ratio, so you might actually get more for your darbepoietin alpha if your patient's in high doses of EPO. Similar adverse event profile to EPO, and so far there's no antibodies detected against Dabrafenib alpha. Of course, it is early days. Now, I just want to finish off with a brief word about what's new this year for anemia management. I think there are three issues that we can focus on. One is once-weekly erythropoietic substances. Secondly, this interesting concept of ACE inhibitors affecting ACE response, bearing in mind we're using these more and more in our dialysis population. And of course, I cannot get away in this lecture without saying something about PRCA. So briefly, brief word about once-weekly EPO. Now, there are quite a number of studies now looking at darbepoetin alpha efficacy studies suggesting that once-weekly administration is appropriate. The references are here. I don't think you need to, I'm not going to go through them individually. Just recognize that there's quite a body of evidence saying once-weekly darbepoetin alpha is effective. That begs the question then about what about once-weekly recombinant human erythropoietin? Traditionally, we've been giving erythropoietin on the dialysis three times a week. The answer is why, or the question is why. Partly this is due to pharmacokinetics because of its short half-life, but the major reason is that these patients come in to dialyze three times a week, if it's very appropriate to give them three times a week, and of course, all the early studies of recombinant human erythropoietin were in hemodialysis patients given three times a week, so the habit stuck. Then the question is really about, what about once-weekly EPO? Now, in fact, this isn't all that new. This is a paper from 1991, looking at once-weekly. This is the first paper on giving once-weekly recombinant human erythropoietin, and it was to peritoneal dialysis patients, but then there were studies in hemodialysis patients after that. I'm not going to go through these studies. Again, they're summarized in your program book if you want them. There's also an editorial about to, that I've written that's appearing in next month's NDT on this issue of once-weekly erythropoietic therapy, summarizing all these studies. This is the ones from 1991 to 92. So you can see, 10 years ago, there were lots of once-weekly studies of recombinant human EPO. There are more studies between 1994 and 1997, summarized here. Some of them comparison studies, some of them just efficacy studies. And there's no doubt that following the introduction of darbepoetin alpha as a once-weekly therapy, there was renewed interest from the other companies in giving EPO once-weekly. Clearly, this was only relevant for subcutaneous use. And you'd last Weiss's study and Francesco Locatelli's study looking at selected iron replete and well dialyzed hemo patients showing the equivalence of once-weekly excuse me. I left my water here, someone's pinched it. Can't leave anything but anyway, carry on a moment. Concluding showing the equivalence of once-weekly dosing of EPO, it's erythropoietin beta with two or three times, thank you very much, weekly dosing. And then there's a recent European study presented at the EDTA meeting just 2 months ago, reporting similar results with once weekly and once every other week dosing of recombinant human erythropoietin. So there is an emerging interest in erythropoietin beta as once weekly therapy in Europe, and it's mainly been driven by the introduction of darbepoetin alpha to the market. Erythropoietin alpha also has once weekly studies. There's a non-randomized correction study which was presented at this very meeting by Roberto Provenzano a year ago, published as an abstract in JSON, obviously. And then there was this study by Paul Barry from Canada, a multi-center study, again non-randomized, but converting hemodialysis patients from subcutaneous or IV erythropoietin alpha three times a week to the same route of administration once a week. This was not the case for intravenous administration. And the only randomized control data you've got of erythropoietin alpha is this pharmacodynamic study that was published in the European Journal of Clinical Pharmacology a year or so ago, showing that in healthy adults, once-weekly recombinant human erythropoietin was the same as for three times a week. So basically, what do we know about comparing the once-weekly erythropoietic agents? The efficacy data support intravenous darbepoetin alpha once a week. I think that's fair to say. This frequency is not appropriate for IV recombinant human erythropoietin. So basically, if you're wanting to continue with intravenous use, you really cannot give this once a week. And at the moment, there's no study of a head-to-head comparison of once-weekly darbepoetin alpha with once-weekly recombinant human erythropoietin. You can ask the companies why they haven't done that. Brief word to finish then, ACE inhibitors and EPO response, one slide. I think we recognize that in certain patients, and it's not in everybody, and it may be due to their ACE genotype, that ACE inhibitors will suppress EPO response. If you stop the ACE inhibitor in some patients, the hemoglobins will increase. It's a very nice paper from published in the American Journal of Kidney Diseases last year showing this is probably due to this pentapeptide, which basically suppresses erythropoiesis, and it's normally degraded by ACE. So if you've got an ACE inhibitor, then basically you will accumulate this substance and this inhibits erythroid growth. You will not see this with A2 blockers, which is why if you've got patients anemic on ACE inhibitors, the A2 blockers might be an appropriate switch. Final word just about PRCA. What do we know about this condition? Well, unfortunately, we don't know as much as we'd like. But the things we do know are basically that this year only, it's been found particularly that neutralizing antibodies to erythropoietin can cause PRCA. And Nicole Castro-Duval's paper drew that to a head. This condition has been more widely reported since 1998. So this is a recent phenomenon, really only in the last 3 or 4 years. It seems to be commoner with epoietin alpha than with epoietin beta. And I know you don't have epoietin beta in the US, but we certainly have it in Europe, and certainly the epoietin beta companies are loving this. It seems to be commoner with subcutaneous administration than with intravenous administration. There's ongoing research to look at that. And there's certainly a rationale for that. It seems to be commoner in dialysis patients that are male over the age of 60 to 70 years. The antibodies are directed against the protein portion of the molecule, so they'll cross-react with all erythropoietic substances. And the antibodies are IgG, subtype G4, in most cases, sometimes G1. Unfortunately, the things we don't know, excuse me, I summarized here, we don't know how common this condition is. Nathan. Get the frog in the throat here. Why has there been an apparent increase in reporting of this condition since 1998? Well, we don't really know that. I think we've all got theories. Is this condition common to all erythropoietic agents, or is it specific to epoietin alpha? And if it is specific to epoietin alpha, is it specific to one brand, which again is what's being suggested? Is it really more common subcutaneously than intravenously? Certainly there's a rationale for this, but does the evidence back that up? We need to know. We still don't know what the cause or the causes of this condition are. It's probably multifactorial. And what are the characteristics of the anti-APO antibodies? Ongoing research has been done on that. I heard the other day, very worryingly, that there have been 2 cases now in Germany of patients with anti-APO antibodies who do not have PRCA. That's very worrying. It suggests that there is a phase where they're not neutralizing, and do these antibodies then become neutralizing? So there's a lot of questions we need answers to. This is my second last slide. Future of renal anemia management. I think in the next year or two, we're going to see new delivery systems. Some of you may be aware of these being marketed. There's a needle-free device that's going to be launched probably next year. The patent for recombinant human erythropoietin runs out in the year 2004, so that'll open the door to generic companies making EPO. There's basic science research looking at other strategies for stimulating erythropoiesis, notably the EPO-mimetic peptides and the HCP inhibitors, and there may be one day orally active treatment for stimulating erythropoiesis. EPO gene therapy is really science fiction. I don't know if it'll ever become reality. It's fraught with all the complications of gene therapy. The benefits of treating renal anemia are considerable in terms of heart, quality of life, exercise capacity. I think we should be trying to keep the hemoglobin in our population of patients above 11 if possible, and we should be aiming for earlier correction of anemia. Thank you.
We have some time for some questions. Yep.
Joanna Rowinski, Poland. Intravenous iron therapy is becoming more and more popular. Don't you think that routinely given, it could aggravate cardiovascular problems through its oxidizing properties?
Well, it's a very good point. I mean, we know that intravenous iron probably in the laboratory will increase oxidative stress. I have yet to see any evidence that it does any harm clinically in our patients. And certainly, leaving them anemic probably does much more harm than giving them intravenous iron. So until there's clinical evidence that it's detrimental, I would suggest we still give intravenous iron.
Robin Laurie from British Columbia. I'd just like to make a comment about oral iron. British Columbia has introduced a program of getting more patients on oral iron. They take 150 milligrams at bedtime so as not to conflict with phosphate binders. And it seems to be quite well tolerated, and it seems to reduce requirements for IV iron.
Yes, thanks for the comment. There's certainly literature that suggests that oral iron is effective. Certainly all the randomized control studies of oral versus intravenous iron, bar one, shows that intravenous iron is superior to oral iron. So yes, you can maybe reduce your dose requirements of EPO with oral iron. Personally, if you ask the patients if they have side effects with oral iron, you'll be amazed at how many of them actually admit to side effects. Many of them don't actually tell you until you ask them. But if you actually go looking for side effects, a very high percentage of patients in oral iron have them. And as I say, that's one of the posters of this very meeting that looked at that and asked the patient if it's side effects. And Charitan's abstract certainly suggests that the adverse effects with oral iron is much, much greater than with intravenous iron. Bearing in mind we have safe intravenous iron preparations nowadays. We're not needing to use dextran anymore. So I personally don't use any oral iron in my unit at all. If the patient needs iron, they get it intravenously.
With regards to the EPO antibodies, I know that in the last few years, EPO alpha has increased the rate of cases with the antibodies. In this case, it's not demonstrated that the beta EPO is keeping the same level cases every year. So, do you think that in this moment is recommend to use the EPO alpha by subcutaneous via because it's the more often causes antibodies?
Well, you raised several issues that I've alluded to in the presentation. I don't think at the moment we have any evidence that it's all epoetin alphas. It does seem to be more common with epoetin alpha. But is it all epoetin alphas, or is it just one brand of epoetin alpha? And I'm aware of certainly some data suggesting the latter. So I think we have to be very careful when we say it's epoetin alpha. There are several formulations of epoetin alpha in the world, and certainly the data that I've seen suggests it may be just one formulation. The evidence for it being more common subcutaneously than intravenously is also not particularly robust. It's confounded by the fact that many of these patients come from Europe, where subcutaneous administration is used anyway. And there is clustering of cases in France, in the UK, not so much in Germany and Italy. And these are the countries that are using subcutaneous administration anyway. And the trouble with the US, you don't have much of this as a problem, but then you don't use very much of it subcutaneously. So I don't really think we know the answer to the subcutaneous versus intravenous route. Certainly there's a rationale for more antibodies coming subcutaneously, but I still think we need more information.
In fact, in Spain, we changed the route of administration from subcutaneous to intravenous because of it was proven that the subcutaneous EPO alpha produced more antibodies than the intravenous.
Well, that's fine. You have to then recognize that if you're using epoetin alpha intravenously, you'll probably require higher doses than the subcutaneously in most of your patients. But when you've got a reimbursement scheme as you do in the US, that's less of a problem. In many countries in Europe, and certainly in the poorer countries of the world, in the Middle East and Far East, they cannot afford to give it intravenously. They can barely afford to give it subcutaneously.
We'll do the last questions. We can do the last two while we get the computer ready for the next speaker.
Do you have any evidence to disprove the study that showed that hematocrit withdrawal of 42 was associated with a higher cardiovascular morbidity?
So I the microphone's not working. I couldn't really. Any evidence to suggest what?
Any evidence to disprove that the study that was done that showed that the higher hematocrit withdrawal group of up to 42% was associated with higher cardiovascular morbidity?
The normal hematocrit study. Are you talking about the U.S. normal hematocrit study?
I'm talking about the study that studied 1,500 plus patients in two arms. One was to reach a goal of 42%.
That's right. It's the U.S. normal hematocrit study, published by Besarab and colleagues in the New England Journal in 1998. Yeah, I mean, it's a very good study. It's the largest anemia management study ever conducted. It did have conclusions. It was aborted early. And I think
you have to bear in mind these were high-risk cardiac patients that were due to die anyway, very soon, and that's one of the caveats of the study. And I think it's a slightly inconclusive study. I could talk for the next hour about reasons why it's of limited value to us, and you have to remember there are other multi-center studies that did not show the same effect, albeit with different selection inclusion criteria.
Last question.
My question is regarding the functional iron deficiency that you mentioned. First, what is the rationale for the ascorbic acid? And secondly, when it fails, what do you do? Like with the patient who has a ferritin of 800 and a TSAT of 10%, do you keep giving iron or call it
right? That's a nice question. Firstly, the rationale is that it's very high dose of ascorbic acid. It's not vitamin C supplementation. This is pharmacological doses of vitamin C. 300 milligrams intravenously every dialysis session. It's a massive dose. The rationale for giving it is that it mobilizes iron from the stores. That's what the theory is, because your ferritin levels go down and your TSAT levels go up. That's the rationale. What do you do about the patient who doesn't respond? That's a very much harder question. You do not go on giving them intravenous iron. The same study from Taiwan actually showed these patients will not respond to intravenous iron. It was a control study with an intravenous iron arm and an ascorbic acid arm. The ascorbic acid arm did well. The intravenous iron did absolutely nothing if your ferritin's already high. So that's why I think there's very good evidence for not giving intravenous iron once your ferritin's above 500 or 600 and certainly 800. There's no rationale for giving more intravenous iron. What you do with that patient, I really don't have an answer to if ascorbic acid doesn't work.